So I'm sitting here in the office of Latvian Prime Minister, Kristijanis Kariņš, who's now a month into the job, as he keeps telling people. thank you very much for making time for LSM English. And sure. I just wanted to start off really with you giving a little bit of an introduction about yourself. Who are you and where do you come from?
Well, I've been a politician since 2002, so that makes me in Latvian politics a little bit of an old-timer. I have been in parliament, I've been in government, I've been in opposition, and for the past more than 9.5 years, a member of the European Parliament, elected twice. So I have been active in politics for not quite, but what, 18, 19, not full 20 years. 18 years, I guess, 17, 18 years, family man.
But before that, I mean, you were born in the States.
I was born in the States. Both of my parents, Latvians, as children, they fled in October of 1944 with their respective families. They both ended up in Sweden. That's where they both grew up. That's where they met. That's where they married. Then they emigrated to the U.S., and that's where my elder sister, I, and younger sister were born.
And obviously it was, I mean, how old were you when you came to Latvia for the first time then?
I have to think, I was still, I was 19. I guess I was 19. Yes, I was 19.
But then I guess growing up, you must have had an image in your head or some sort of idea of what Latvia was. Could you describe that? I mean, you were growing up in a Latvian household, just not
Latvia
in Latvia.
Latvia was the land where the grass is greener, the forests are more beautiful, the air is crisper, the people are nicer, the food is tastier, and life in general is outstanding.
But this was, I mean, there's a certain amount of irony in what you're saying.
I don't mean to say it in an ironic way. What I mean to say is that in the emigre community, Latvia was idealized by my parents' generation, and that was taken on board my generation. So I grew up in two parallel cultures, daily life, regular American school, the only Latvian in my class, and barring my elder sister, the only two Latvians in the school. And so when we were she was three classes ahead of me. So when I was in what was there, the junior high school and the high school systems, I was the only Latvian in the school because she was always one up. You know, she graduated high school before I started high school. I guess that's how it worked out. But of course, at home, together with my cousins who lived nearby, we had a very close-knit Latvian family. We lived in a community of Latvians in the north of Delaware, probably at its best numbering, say, 150 people. Latvian church on Sundays, Latvian Sunday school, in the summers, Latvian camp. As I was older, I worked at these camps. I spent most of my weekends when I was young. I played in various bands, but the one that was the sort of the never-changing was with my Latvian friends, so we would travel all over the U.S., being invited to play at weddings, etc., etc.
What did you play? Instrument-wise?
I was a guitarist. I would also play the drums. Sometimes we would play. I would play bass guitar because we would switch instruments. And on a couple of songs, I got to play piano, but I'm only good for C major. So I'm very lousy at most instruments. But of course, I sang, and as most Latvians do. So that's how I spent my youth, very deeply engaged in the Latvian community, not politically active. I was active in the sense that I went along with all the demonstrations against the occupation of the Baltic states that happened regularly on the 14th of June in Washington, D.C., which was not so far away. We held demonstrations in Philadelphia by the Liberty Bell. There's a park there. These demonstrations usually held together with always held together with the Lithuanians and the Estonians. But I never took an a very active role in the organizations. Other colleagues of mine, Vita Tārauda, who's now in the Latvian parliament, she was very active when we were young. She's a very close friend of one of my sisters. Some others, Kārlis Cērbulis, was very active politically when we were young. Pauls Raudzeps was in the same camp system, and we grew up together. Nils Malngaus, but I was together, but I wasn't. And the reason was that I always felt that I simply knew far too little. I felt that
I know that feeling. It's okay.
you really can't do that. And I became a politician. Actually, without the thought of becoming a politician, which I think is quite common. I had moved to Latvia with my wife. She's from Riga, a doctor. We had moved here and were living in Riga, and I was in business. I have a PhD in linguistics. I was a phoneticist. I worked on language automation, so teaching computers how to understand spoken language, part of a fairly big effort in the early 1990s. I was engaged in that, in automatic speech recognition, I guess that's what you would call it. And I wanted to work as an academic, and the university system simply shut me out. It was fine until I moved to Riga and actually showed up for the interview, and then they found a clause saying, you don't have 10 years experience as a teacher, so you can't teach. And it was true, but they knew it before I came, and I had sent my dissertation. I had actually publications in very reputable journals at the time. As a young academic, I was fortunate enough to study in actually one of the, at the time, and I still think one of the best research institutes in this field, at the University of Pennsylvania. It still has one of the leading institutes, the Linguistic Data Consortium, where I used to work, which is still very active. And I didn't get a job as an academic, and I realized my goal was to participate in the life of the country. In the U.S., 300 more million people coming in all the time. Latvia, with a much smaller population and a tendency to diminish, I felt that here I really could make a difference as any individual in this country. You also, as a journalist, we all actually have a big impact as individuals. And so I became a businessman, which is the next logical step. If they're not going to give me a job, well, I'll create my own. And so I got into the frozen foods business, no educational background on this, manufactured ice, sold ice cream, pelmeni, everything frozen in your freezer. This is what I would sell. And in the process of doing this, I came across a cumbersome system, which I thought in many ways didn't make sense from an entrepreneur's point of view. Why do I have to fill this form? Why this procedure? This doesn't make sense. Why couldn't I just do it this way? Why does the state assume I'm a criminal? Which is the way that it felt at the time. And then when Einar Srepša said he was going to form a political party, this was in the summer of 2001, I joined. And I got in touch with him, and I said, my name, my background, it meant nothing to him. He said, do you have any ideas? I said, yes. He said, can you put them down on paper? Yes. A couple of months later, I had put down, actually put together in retrospect, which was a party platform. Mm-hmm. I sent it to him. I got a call the next day. Can you come by this evening? I was invited into the formation of Jaunais Laiks, of New Era. I was, person number 10 or 11, maybe. A couple of people were ahead of me. Many were behind. This was about almost 1 year before the party itself was formed, in the pre-formation process. And in that process, I got to know people. You learn how to work in a very different environment, a collaborative environment, to come up with good ideas and specific proposals. My colleagues asked me to run for office. After a longer conversation with my wife, I agreed. And the rest is history. It sort of went on from there.
If I just rewind slightly, it's very interesting that you have this Latvian identity formed when you're growing up in the States. And from what you were saying, when you make this academic application and you get knocked back, it seems maybe that that's a bit of a shock to you. Is there some sort of like culture shock? Was it a case that, you know, your mental picture of Latvia didn't match up with the reality, and that it was, from what you're saying, it sounds like it's this which triggers you to say, I'm going to make a difference?
It's not so black and white, maybe on retrospect somewhat. When I first came in 1984, I think I spent every summer from 1984 until I finally moved here in 1997 completely, and every summer here. And then in the academic year 94-95, I got a great stipend from the US to live here to do research. I also taught at the university, or I held lectures at the university. I guess that's what it would be called. No one paid me. I had a great I had a fantastic stipend from the US. I had never felt so wealthy in my life until then, because I was paid almost the same amount I was paid in Philadelphia, but with almost without any expense. I did a lot of traveling. I did a lot of recording. I saw a lot of the countryside, because my goal was to record pitch accents in Latvian. It's quite an interesting phenomena. One of the oldest remnants of ancient Indo-European, which is still alive, and it's alive in the Latvian language. It's slowly disappearing because of dialects flowing together, of course. But I traveled around the countryside to various parts where the pitch accents have different systems, and look for people to speak with and interview. And you learn a lot, because just as you're asking me about my life, I would ask them about their lives. Mm. And that's how I gathered speech data, which I would then analyze later in an academic manner. But I never analyzed the content academically, but the content impressed me deeply. So I had a fairly good notion of how things were. And I think the shock was in 1984 when I first came to the Soviet Union. Mm. That was a shock. How gray everything was, how run down physically the infrastructure was, and how incredibly warm the people were once you got inside. They were warmer than Latvians in the West, outwardly colder, but inwardly, behind the closed doors, much, much warmer. I could say I fell in love with Latvians, even though I had grown up as a Latvian, but that deeply impressed me. And when I was working, and when I got shut out from the university, well, that was one of the big game changers for me. But it's sort of a principle I've in retrospect, I've held to for a long time, and I tried to hold to now. Well, if you get knocked down, you just get up again. And that's sort of the whole point, isn't it? Just to get up one more time than you're knocked down. Because life's always trying to knock you down, I suppose, or circumstances do. And I simply realized that what I actually wanted was to participate in the life of Latvia. I would have preferred to do it as an academic, but I thought I would be potentially just as happy doing it something else. And as much as I had, you know, I was neck deep in academia, I actually loved my studies. I first enjoyed studying when I was 18 and entered university, 19 and entered university. That's the first time I actually studied for my own sake. Mm. And because I had, how shall we say, such an active social life when I was a little younger, I had maybe gotten a few things out of my system, and I spent my days and my evenings studying. And I felt like I was someone who would, you know, it's like you've never tasted something so delicious. I had never actually read and thought and done things for me. I went, you know, 10 years, and then they gave me a PhD and said, thank you, now you're done. And it was either do something from the ground up or move on as academic. Mm-hmm. Well, when that was closed, then I went into business. And there also, neck deep, and I enjoyed it. And then in politics, this is the longest stretch I've had.
Well, this suggests that you must enjoy politics as well.
I enjoy it very much. And the reason is that it's one thing to criticize and say, this is wrong. It's another thing to have the ability to actually try to make it right. It's difficult, but it's the challenge that I feel. And to me, being now the Prime Minister gives me the greatest potential ability to influence things in a positive way, the way I understand they're positive. The restrictions are, there are the hurdles are many, but it's the overcoming of the hurdles and bringing people together that I very much enjoy. And that's actually how, I think, how I became Prime Minister, bringing people together.
Well, I wanted to ask you as well, that I mean, a couple of years ago, in 2016, when Prime Minister Straujumar stepped down, there was talk about you possibly becoming Prime Minister then, and it seemed like quite a realistic possibility. Why did you choose not to put your name forward at that time, but to do so now, a couple of years later?
I did. I did put my name down, just the party didn't choose me as the candidate. So I was one of three. Mr. Pabriks, myself, and Mr. Daldirs were the three candidates.
But the party ended up not really putting anyone forward properly, did they?
One could say that, but Mr. Pabriks was the candidate at the time chosen. That's how that worked then. And this is actually the third time. The first time was in
2006.
When Vairavity Freiberger had a choice between Mr. Kalvitis and myself. I was my party's candidate. I went to the Riga Castle. I met with her together on the one hand, Einars Repše, and Valdis Dombrovskis on the left. He would have been my finance minister. We went and we offered, and she chose instead Ivars Kalvitis, and I became Minister of Economy instead. So this was time number three. Well, third time's lucky, I guess.
But what is different this time? Because it did seem that you came in swinging a bit more this time. You know, you came in with a certain amount of confidence, even though you would expect maybe to be less confident in that your party has shrunk quite considerably since last time.
Maybe the difference is I feel that I have absolutely nothing to lose, and I absolutely don't owe anyone anything. Literally, politically or otherwise. The closest analogy I can find is, I remember one of my choir, you know, Latvians sing in choirs everywhere, also where I grew up. And one of my choir instructors, a very good friend of mine who's passed away now, I remember him teaching us, you know, we were all younger. I was a young guy, and tenors are always too few. And as my voice changed, they didn't let me to leave the tenors. So I stayed as a tenor, and there you have to use the falsetto a lot. And I was taught once how to hit the high note. The way not to hit a high note is to reach up for it from the bottom. The way to hit the high note is to come down on it from the top. Sit down on the note mentally, and actually it has a big effect on how you do it. In this case, neither I nor my party had any ambition after, well, we got into parliament, which was, we were very happy, but realizing that we were the smallest group, the smallest faction, we didn't have any ambition to, you know, seize power and use our elbows. We watched how one failed, how another failed, then two said, not me. And sort of the balls just simply rolled in our direction. And in the end, four other parties asked me to come. And, well, I had certain conditions. You know, we all come in on parity, because the difference between 8 and 16, that actually we're all small. You know, even if one party with 16 seats feels big, when I was in parliament, the first term we had 26, the second term we had 18. I remember when we went down to 18, it was complete silence, and it felt like the world had stopped, because you can do nothing with 18 seats. In this parliament, 18, I would be the king of the hill. So it's the realization that you're not the king, which actually forces you, or gives an opportunity for those individuals who work on compromise.
But do you not think that this might be a little bit of a honeymoon period, though, and that at some point before too long, 13 is going to seem like a big number again, or 16, or whatever?
It can't seem like a big number. A big number is when you command a significant portion of parliament. So unless some parties, and it's always possible some parties come together. And the honeymoon period, of course it's a honeymoon period, politically on some level, I suppose. not from the trade unions in this, there's no honeymoon given. But, that's just the way that it is. But my political career and the way I used to run, I was the group leader in the parliament. I have always worked on a consensus building process. The meetings I run are a little longer than some, because it's important for me that everyone expresses themselves. Then we come to a common decision, we stick to it, and we move forward. That's the way I built the government and built the coalition. That's the way we have our weekly meetings. That's the way we hold government meetings, is we talk, we argue, we come to one, and we stick to that. And this will work as long as the partners agree that this is a way to work. I will not work against my own ministers. I was in a government where the prime minister actively worked against me. Political rivalries, and I would get all kinds of resolutions. One of my beautiful resolutions I received one day was, "What the hell is this? Petrol prices are going up. How can that be?" The response is, well, buy any book on basic economics, read the first chapter, and I'm sure you'll understand the notion, the very difficult notion of supply and demand. It was just anything to make my political life different. With my ministers, I'm working completely differently. So on the fixing of the financial system, it's a collaborative effort across various ministries, and I'm looking to get the synergies between. Instead of having or allowing individual fiefdoms to flourish, this is what our country is good at. But look where it's gotten us. It's gotten us problems in the healthcare system, problems in education, problems in the banking system, sort of shortcomings in a number of places. We need to address this and fix these. And the way to do it is to get people to come together and actually work for a single cause. That's what I'm interested in. Bringing people together to focus on a cause. And as long as they're willing to work this way, this government can have there's actually no limit. I mean, we could go even full term. If the parties decide that they don't want to do this, then they can topple my government any Thursday without even a special meeting, or any day of the week, because what can my party do with 8 votes? And the opposition will join, so it's easy. So I have nothing to lose. I have nothing to fear. And everyone went through the difficult process. And my I think the experience in the European Parliament, where you have to work on a consensus, there is no government in opposition. It's a fluid coalition of moving majorities. Where on any issue, I was forced and learn to some degree, I hope, how to work with people who have very opposing views at the outset. The key is to find the common view, find the common thread, agree to that. And it took us a while, but I think that we're there. Everyone's not fully on the same page, but the positive news is that I'm working with the ministers and they are working with me. They're also coming to me and say, hey, we should talk about this because I want us to be on the same page.
And you have quite a few ministers who don't really have much experience. So is it a case of you having to kind of mentor them initially?
I wouldn't want to say that. I don't mean, I dare not,
Well, I don't think there's any disgrace in that. I mean, if you're new in the job.
The interesting thing about this government, and even with me heading this government, the voters, I mean, it's always a question, what did the voters say, But one could argue that looking at the sheer number of new parliamentarians, that this was a vote for change. Maybe unclear which direction, but sort of it was a lot of out with the old, in with the new. Ironically, as the head of the government, I am one of the old. I don't feel very old, but in terms of being in Latvian politics, there are a few who've been longer, but not very many today, in terms of being in active politics. But On many ways, I am coming from the outside. The sheer fact that I grew up in a different society is part of that. But a very big part is that for 10 years, I've been working in a different parliament, in the European Parliament, that has a different work ethos, a different way of working with colleagues, which is not working against, it's working with. And I'm bringing that ethos into my style of governing. It seems that...
So far, so good.
it seems that people like that. And I've noticed everywhere where I've worked that actually people enjoy being part of something if they're part of it. Mm. No one likes being rolled over by a steamroller. And if you push people in the wrong way, they object. And so my challenge is, it's one thing to work well in government. I think our government has a very good chance of working well. I very much enjoy our government meetings. I very much enjoy our closed meetings. These are collegial. Even when we disagree, we're actually disagreeing about substance. Mm. Not, you know, your party, my party, you guys are crazy, or this. That is completely gone. Then working with parliament is a little more challenging because I don't have the privilege of working with all the parliamentarians on a daily basis. They don't know me as well as I would like them to know me, and I don't know them as well as I would like to know them. That will take more time. And then, of course, the most challenging thing was with society as a whole. And so I spend a lot of my time thinking about how to explain what we're doing so that people, they can like it or not like it, but I want them to at least understand it. You know, criticize me for the right things, not the imagined things.
So they feel that you're being square with them.
I really want to be square, and not everything that I say, and actually, you could say none of it is aimed just to, you know, to soothe, you know, to tell people good stories just so they feel good. I say, and our government says, we need to make some pretty big changes in order to live better. We all want to live better. But if we want to live better, then we have to make some changes. One of my political goals is to increase the amount of investment coming into our economy. We have a mismatch between talent and capital. The investment that has been coming in over the past 20 years, there are wonderful, wonderful exceptions to this, but a lot or too much has been geared towards exploiting our relatively cheap labor force. That's a road to nowhere. We all say we want to live in a knowledge economy. Everyone wants a bigger wage. The way to do that is to get capital coming in, which creates the goods and services that are expensive that can afford to pay good wages. And we have a mismatch, very talented people, actually very well educated, too little capital. Then I ask myself, why this lack of capital? And I think one of the reasons is a not full belief or trust that our country is a good one to invest in. We have, unfortunately, a reputation that we're going to be changing through our actions, not the words, of a financial system which has been, shall we say, too lenient or not strong enough against money laundering. So is it a clean system or not? We're cleaning it up. We're going to be changing our the remit and the way that the bank watchdog is elected. We're going to be changing legal presumption, you know, the burden of proof. Right now, it's almost impossible for our courts to prosecute because of the burden of proof is placed on the state, not on the individual. Mm. In money laundering cases, we're going to work to make the prosecutor's office reduce the amount of paperwork that they're dealing with on small cases so that they can focus on the big cases. We're going to be changing that system to have the trust that, yes, this is a good place for clean investment because that's the kind of investment we want.
But isn't part of the problem that for, well, a decade at least, people have been saying here, we're on top of the problem. Yeah, we used to have a problem. It's not really there anymore. This has been coming from the regulator, this has been coming from certain of the banks and so on. And it was kind of felt that really, you know, the system wasn't terribly bad. Then we had this huge shock with ABLV and the allegations of institutionalized money laundering from the US last year, and it made everyone take up and, you know, sit up and take notice. They worked the money vial deadline, And then it kind of came off the gas again. Now, since you took office, to be fair, you have in almost every speech addressed to kind of a foreign audience that I've seen said our number one priority is cleaning up the
system. I have signed last week resolutions. It took 4 weeks. We identified the main faults in the, shall we say, the legal code that we'll be changing.
They have a month to do that.
I managed to get our two independent, the bank watchdog and the FIU, to agree on a methodology for actually liquidating this bank, which was shut down, to make sure that money's paid out or clean, that we have the proper the mesh or the methodology to check those monies. They had been unable in 6 months to come to any agreement. I had the first meeting with them and all the other ministers and associations and criminal police and prosecutors, everyone in the same room. I listened to all the reports coming from all the sides on the money valve, what's being done. A lot of it's actually being taken care of very well, I think. And here we have this big glaring bank that we're going to liquidate, but we don't even have a methodology. I don't become angry very often. I did become angry. I said 2 weeks, I closed the meeting. And in 2 weeks' time, they came back and they had agreed on a methodology. That's very good because I had two sets of resolutions prepared for that day. One set of resolutions was if they had not agreed, well, they're in the dustbin now. Mm-hmm. The other set of resolutions for if they agree. But in both cases, I understood even if they agree, which they did, we still have other things that we need to make. And it's what I'm calling an overhaul of the legal framework to fight money laundering. I have a little bit of experience on this because the past two AML directives of the 4th and the 5th, I was one of the co-rapporteurs together with a Dutch colleague of mine, a very wonderful, very well-informed woman coming from the Green Party in the Netherlands. So I happen to be quite deep in these issues.
Anyway. You were quite strong on the whole ultimate beneficiary.
Well, that was the register of beneficial ownership is one that I came up with when I was still at the time writing an opinion for the Econ Committee, which ended up being a co-rapporteurship. And at first it was rejected by the European Commission. Later, everyone has now jumped on board and has taken ownership of it. I'm very happy about that. Understanding the entire notion of risk-based, and what our system has been doing is more, shall we say, the formal tick-the-box approach. Mm. But the tick-the-box approach got us nowhere. That's my general assessment. And I realized, and I actually read the entire Moneyval recommendation. It's actually a very good recommendation because it points to the things which sort of you feel aren't right, but then you see more more directly. Mm. And we're going to change that. And to get the investment, this is one part of it. The educational system, that's another part of it. We have, again, sort of a mismatch. We have fantastic schools preparing kids that, you know, go into university and in the first 2 years they don't have to do any maths because the school is so advanced. And then we have also schools that where the kids who are educated there have difficulty getting in or actually keeping up with university work in our own country, let alone going to Germany or Sweden or France, we have a territorial administrative grid which is sort of in a limbo between what was intended and what was hoped for, and there was this voluntary and it sort of stopped, which means that some territorial entities have 20, 30,000 people, even more. They are well-financed. They have centers where there's business and jobs. And then we have others of 1,000 people that there's no center, there's no jobs. They're trying to support a school. They're trying to support some sort of medical, and they can't afford it. And there is a way to group ourselves better that will help to organize the educational system in terms of where the schools are, et cetera, and also our healthcare system. Without spending more money, we can spend more money more wisely. And in cleaning up these big systems, the territorial reform, which feeds directly into healthcare and directly into education. Together with a better legal framework of having a sound financial system and working on our, how should we say, the entire legal system. So we have a legal system which, if you look at individual parts, they seem to work fine, but when you look at an entire process, it's very cumbersome. Mm-hmm. We are now working on identifying what makes it cumbersome. One of the things we've already identified is that the general prosecutor's office is overwhelmed because they're spending, according to them, one quarter of their time on unneeded, unnecessary, you know, from a practitioner's point of view, unnecessary paperwork on petty crime. Handle that in a quicker way to free up others. And we're still in the process of identifying what else. Because what we have a number of high-profile cases which are, to me as a politician, frustrating, that we have, say, the anti-corruption agency comes up with a case, turns it over rather efficiently in terms of time to the general prosecutor's office, but then it takes the general prosecutor's office a long time to bring it to the courts. But it seems that what we have are loopholes where clever defense lawyers can buy time, buy time. And we have to close those loopholes, because I think the hallmark of any good legal system is speedy and efficient and fair justice.
It sounds like you need to have another couple of 2 weeks deadlines, doesn't it? Because, I mean, reform of the legal system is clearly needed, and there are several high-profile cases where people are waiting on verdicts, and according to which way the verdict's going to go will have a significant effect on public opinion and political sentiment.
Agreed. If it was so simple, I would have these meetings every day. But, for example, right now we're in the process on teacher salaries, of looking into the system. What can we do to increase teacher salaries without putting more money in the pot? Because there is no more money to put into the pot. So it's a question of... because I am opposed to just raising taxes because we can't solve our problems. That's not fair to the taxpayer. It's bad for business as well. If government as an entire structure can't get itself together, the wrong solution is to raise taxes, but it has been the solution always. Salaries are too low. Let's just throw more money at it without reforming the system, without making the system more efficient. I have a history also as a businessman. I don't think running a country or working in politics and working a business are analogous. Actually, I've come to the conclusion that the skills needed are often very different.
Glad to hear it. There are a few people who believe in that a little bit too much at the moment.
But one thing I do know, there are certain analogies. And for example, in a business, say you have seven people working the till and seven people who are getting a lousy wage, where maybe it would be enough to have three people in a shift, in shifts working the till, three people who have good wages rather than seven people who have bad wages. In our educational system, for years, the number of students has been declining, but the number of educators, so teachers and other pedagogical staff, has been quite steady. Actually, in the past years, it's actually increased. So there's a mismatch between how many people are part of the system as students and the number of people teaching or participating in teaching. In other words, it's a sad fact that I have taken from Eurostat. And if you simply look at a ratio of pupils and students to teachers and academic staff by education level and program orientation, so in high schools, our country, it looks like we're extremely generous. We have one of the lowest student-teacher ratios, which means, my goodness, it's exclusive. We are just where Luxembourg is, except they're the wealthiest society in Europe, and we're unfortunately one of the unwealthiest. But if you look at individual schools, it turns out in Riga you have classrooms of more than 30 kids, so there's no exclusivity. In the other regional centers, the number is 20, 22, which is a great number for, you know, in terms of a teacher-student ratio, that's already quite exclusive. But we have individual schools where the ratio of teachers to students is 1-1 or 1-2. And in the long term, this is not sustainable. Then what we have on top of it is teachers. The number is high because often teachers are working on half shifts or one-third shifts, running from school to school, being tired, spending time, money on travel. The teacher is run down, not well paid. The student, say in a school like this, if the mathematics or the physics teacher arrives only on Wednesdays, but what if you didn't understand something this Wednesday? You have a question, you have to wait until next Wednesday. But then already the teacher is teaching new material and the student ends up falling behind and everyone is unhappy. The students are not at fault. The teachers themselves are not at fault. But the system has to be changed. And now we're looking for how can we make that change? We see a two-year process to enact the territorial reform. But I will not have 2 years of the entire society, oh, Mr. Prime Minister, thank you, we'll come back to you in 2 years. People are unhappy today.
But don't you effectively, I mean, you have this 1 year with the kind of budget situation that you've inherited, and that your administration then has basically, after a year's time, got to sort of get a second wind. And this, presumably, is the point at which you attack these very large issues that you're discussing.
Yes, but in order to be able to attack them from the budget year 2020, I have to solve them this year, which means I'm solving them now.
So this is like a research and development year, and it goes into action next year.
That's the fastest, because the idea that there's so much money in the budget we can find it, of course, makes intuitive sense. But when you actually look at the way the budget is divided, so one-fifth of the budget goes to the regional councils, the local authorities. Then a lot of the budget, an incredible amount of simple social payments, so social tax going to social benefits, including healthcare. And when you actually look at, and then we have the 2% going to defense, when you actually look at discretionary spending, as any government, there's not an incredible amount of leeway. We took over a budget that had 44 million euros promised more than our allowed deficit. We managed to squeeze the budget, squeeze 44 million out of the budget, keeping all of the promises that were made, a feat which is, how shall we say, not small. For budget year 2020, I already have 87 pledged more than I can afford. If this year, without having the ability to change policy, we were able to take care of 44 million. Next year, in order to have any hope of handling 87, we have to massively change some systems. So on the bank or the financial system, I have the advantage of an external crisis sharpening minds. We have to do it.
Well, this kind of touches on something I wanted to ask you as well. You don't have this fiscal space, whatever you call it, to play with, but there are indications that, you know, globally and certainly in Europe, the economic cycle is maybe starting to trail away a little bit.
Yes.
Last time Latvia went into an economic downturn, there weren't any reserves the way that there were in some other countries, and Latvia suffered greatly as a result and had to go into a very deep austerity program. Are you concerned that we're going to find ourselves in the same situation where, you know, due to external factors largely, the economy starts to trail off and we're not able to ameliorate that amongst particularly the most vulnerable members of society who might have to suffer all over again?
Well, I don't see that there are indicators of that kind of a crisis looming in the world or the European economy, but there are strong indicators of a slowdown in growth. That's clear. Our country still has this year and next European funds coming in. So we're at the tail end of a cycle, which will help to, soften any external weakness in the European economy, which I translate that. I have about 1 year's time to enact reforms to help us get by on less. That's the goal.
And speaking of deadlines, if I could just reel you back to the new regime, as it were, for the financial sector. You've got, in 3 weeks' time, this plan's going to be delivered, but when do you think it will be in place? Is this another by the end of the year sort of?
The plan is 26 March. I believe it's 26, but you have to check the date. It's a Tuesday. Government adopts the package. We send it to Parliament. Parliament would look in three readings. So April, May, June. By the end of June, by the end of this parliamentary term,